Hi, listeners. We're thrilled to continue our latest Future of Women podcast series. In this four-part series, our host Momoko Nakamura takes us around the world to speak with brilliant and creative Japanese women. Today, on our fourth and final episode in the series, Momoko speaks with journalist Yumiko Sakama about inspiring people to be vocal, active participants in political change. This episode was recorded on November 15th, 2021.
Welcome to the Future of Women podcast. I am Momoko, a cultural conservationist and storyteller, exploring Japanese food culture beyond cooking and eating. As your host across four episodes, I have the great privilege of speaking with four brilliant, creative, audacious Japanese women. While their personal experiences and professional backgrounds vary, they share the unique quality of leveraging their sense of humor, curiosity, ingenuity, and concern to tickle the minds of Japanese women by prompting thought, perspective, discussion, and action. Today, I am honored to speak with writer, producer, and activist Yumiko Sakama. Thank you, Yumiko-san.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm so excited to speak. I had always hoped that someday I would get to sit down and chat with you, but I never envisioned that this first time properly speaking with you would be in English.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you so much.
I actually first learned about you when I read your book, Hip na Seikatsu Kakume. I think, is the English version called Hip Revolution?
There is no English version, but when I tell people what the book was about, I use that title in English.
Mm-hmm. Hip Revolution. Thank you for writing that. I think it was published in 2014 or 2015?
14, yes.
14. So I was quite late to the Sakuma Yumiko fan club. but your humorous and just such insightful writing, I suspect really tickled the minds of so many women and men in Japan. And I was wondering what led you to publish this book.
I quit my full-time job, my last full-time job, end of 2002. I started working for magazines and I started to write for mostly lifestyle and also men's magazines. I did that because I was intimidated by female women's magazines. I liked filling deadlines in front of me and that I always enjoyed that. And I always thought that was my strength. And originally my editor, I have done three books with them. My editor, he pretty much asked me, like, do you want to write a book? Mm-hmm. And I did say yes. I did sit on it for a few years. And I kept writing small chunks. Never really completed it until I broke my leg and I was grounded.
Was that the reason? Interesting. Yeah.
And that's when I told myself, maybe this is a sign that I need to finish this book.
And why this topic?
At the time, I wrote a lot about things that were happening around me in Brooklyn. And I mostly wrote those stories for Popeye and other men's magazines or lifestyle magazines. First, the idea of writing a book was so overwhelming. So I had to come up with a theme. But for years, living in New York, I always felt like a stranger observer. The idea of New York being this really intimidating, kind of exclusive in a way that, like, you go to a club or something and whether you get in or not will be judged based on the way you dress. I always felt a little bit like a stranger in this big city. The financial crisis happened in 2008. 2009. Originally, I thought it was like a horrible thing. A lot of friends of mine lost their jobs. But then a while later, things started to happen around me. People who lost their jobs started to do their own thing, open their businesses. And it slowly went from this world of mass production and luxury and expensive champagne and house music in the hotel to more conscious, more ethical way of thinking about consumption. And it was a gradual shift. I was writing small stories and I thought there was a consistent thread in all these small stories. And how about I connect small stories into a bigger story.
I'm curious about a couple of things, actually. One is, how do you perceive men's publications versus women's publications in Japan, and why you had chosen to write mostly for men's publications? And then also, why this topic of lifestyle in New York, or the New York way of thinking, why it so intrigues people in Japan?
I wonder that myself too. The reason why I went to men's magazines was I did have more personal connections to editors for men's magazines. That's a practical reason, but I was also intimidated by women's magazine. And it's a little bit twisted. And this is way before I had learned of feminism. I didn't make my personal connection until much later, right? I went to a girls' school, all girls' school for 12 years. When your world is that, your view on women inevitably gets skewed. And I think that women's magazines were covering didn't really get me all that much. Say beauty, say the way they cover troubles or movies they write about, it didn't really fit my world. And mm-hmm. I always felt that they were not for me. This is all very twisted, and it's interesting to even for me to even think about. But I always wore men's clothes, and I think I did that to hide my body lines. I didn't treat it as a woman. I was also into vintage clothing and American casual wear as a kid. So menswear, men's magazines, or topics that they were covering at the time felt a lot more familiar to me than what women's magazine would cover. I quit my job when there was not much going on in menswear world in New York. You know, it was almost a coincidence that I found my career in menswear, but the fact that nobody was doing it helped me building my career.
Yes. And do you think that the Japanese people's interest in New York state of mind and lifestyle is a result of the content that's available for women and the content that's available for men being very separate? What intrigues people about your life in New York?
I don't know if New York is all that special compared to other places, for example, like Milan or Paris, right? I always felt Japanese people were obsessed with Paris.
Several decades ago, Paris is really kind of hot and people wanted to know the food and fashion that was coming out of Paris. And then I feel like you were part of this kind of generation of showcasing New York and its unique and kind of like sumptuous qualities that maybe didn't exist in a city like Tokyo. And then now with the changing of the tides and people looking for more, I don't know, sustainable ways of living than a place like Portland or Copenhagen, I think attracts people and their kind of day-to-day conversations about what's happening outside of Japan. Do you feel that that's the case as well?
I definitely feel like I'm part of this gentrification of Brooklyn, for sure. I have been jokingly accused of being a huge part of gentrifying Brooklyn, especially when it comes to like Japanese population. I've lived in New York for 25 years at this point. I moved there in 98, and I never thought that I live in New York for that long. I'm not good at making long-term plans, but I never imagined being there for this long. And the part of reason why is that New York never stopped amazing me. Always stories. So I think the fact that New York has all these different layers of attractions, and it is for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Like, visited me and there are a lot of things that she wants to do. There are a lot of things that a kid can do. And my biggest fascination was that people who come to New York, they leave their places behind and they want to be their best. And that leads to a lot of different phenomena, whether it's in food or cinema or fashion. And so it was always exciting for me. And I was always looking for things that I had never seen before. That translates very easy to the Japanese context.
In what way?
I feel like you have to be somewhat culturally inclined to appreciate and understand Paris. A lot of cultural phenomena happen on the street of New York, and it becomes a bigger thing. And I think as a writer, I always wanted to find that before it gets better. Cultural seas, that was my goal, my beat.
You had just touched upon this a little bit, but how aware are you of the type of readership or following you have?
The first good 10 to 15 years, most of my readers were men. And that was because I wrote for mostly men's and unisex magazines. And I wrote about specific things that were mostly attractive to, including menswear. And so I wrote my first book. Another editor approached me and said, and she wasn't the only person who said this, but she said that the people who show up in your book are mostly men. And I was like, oh, is that a case? I didn't even think about it that way, but it was true. And she said, you must be surrounded by interesting women. How about you write a book of essays about women around you? Mm-hmm. And that led to my second book. Mm-hmm. And I think I was maybe 41, 42. And that was the moment I had to think about myself as a woman. I didn't want to have children, but I had to ask myself, did I really not want to have children? I didn't want to get married. Well, I had been married, but I decided that I didn't believe in marriage. I had to ask myself, was that really the case? And writing a book about women around me, I knew that was to confront what being a woman meant for me. My reaction to that pitch was, oh no, I don't want to do that. But I ended up deciding that it would be a good thing for me to do for my personal growth. And I did that. It was hard and confusing, but it was also very inspirational. It was definitely painful. A journalist read that. She came to interview me and she said, I only used the word feminism. Twice in the book. They original design used pink on the cover. I said, like, please do not use pink. We settle on the baby blue. I still had such a logic reaction to being a woman or being seen as a woman. And it has been a long journey. I think I avoided thinking about the fact that I'm a woman and I am seen as a woman. I look like a woman. I call myself misogynist sometimes to people. And I do definitely think that I was.
It's interesting because I don't know for sure in terms of data, but my inkling is that you have a very strong fan base of women who are kind of waiting for you to share your insight. And right now, specifically, very much about the Japanese political system and how we can be more active citizens in this country. And I was wondering if you felt this shift of more women listening to what you have to say.
I don't know if people are really like waiting to hear what I have to say, but I do think that more women started to be interested in me, my writing after that book. My book that was called Take Off Your Heels. I definitely want to rewrite the book, but that sort of opened my doors to reach more women. But I think it really was Instagram that, and especially I think more women discovered me because of my friend Eri and because of the Instagram live that I was doing in the very beginning of lockdown last year.
So recent, you felt the shift.
More recent. I did Instagram Live kind of intensely for the first couple months, partly because I felt that Japanese media weren't doing a great job covering what other countries were doing. And also another reason was that I was scared myself and I just didn't want to sit there being scared. I knew that there were a lot of people who were scared and I wanted to share that. It was such a scary moment. And I knew that there were a lot of people. I tried to imagine single people in Tokyo who lived in small apartments who couldn't leave their house and who were just scared. I was doing it around 10 p.m., 11 p.m. in Japan, and I would invite guests from other places so that they can talk about what the New Zealand government was doing or how Taiwanese government was dealing with that. And I think it ended up helping me building a connection with my audience in a very fresh way, in a way that I had never imagined possible.
I mean, I think that it's kind of this raw honesty Yes. that people are attracted to, both in your writing, in your book, but also in the work that you're doing in the digital space to share in this conversation. You are working on several, actually, probably way more different types of projects than I know of, but I was particularly curious about how Sakumag Study came to be and Mondai no Mondai came to be.
Yes. So Sakumag Study. So I started putting out small books, small prints. I started to self-publish and I called that Sakumag. And it wasn't really a magazine, so I don't know why I even called that, but I did. I did that for a few years. And I call my blog that as well. And I wrote my latest book, which is We Live a Revolution. And it was supposed to be a sequel to Hypno Revolution. And again, like I sat on this for years too. Originally, I wanted to put that out a few years ago, but I waited till... So I submitted my draft in February 2020. And my editor had already waited for a while. And COVID happened and the world changed. So I scratched my head and I said, oh, gee, I just submitted this draft that just became moot and I need to rewrite this. As I watch how COVID affected everybody and changed the way we think, changed the way we operate, I wrote the second draft, which it was drastically different from the first draft. I wanted to write that book because I felt the way Japanese people saw the climate crisis was very behind. And I felt that my obligation as a journalist was to talk about it and tell it like it is, because I feel like Japanese people shy away from talking about dangers in a realistic way because nobody wants to give a shocking news. So that was my motivation to write that book. COVID inevitably became a huge part of it. I thought that in the States, being where I was, there was a revolution happening. And I still think it's happening. I think we're going through a phase of backlash and pushback. But I think that we are living in a phase of revolution, right? And I wrote that book. I put it out in December. And usually when I put out a book, I would tour in Japan. I would go to different cities, visit bookstores, do events, hang out with readers, and do book signing and whatnot. I couldn't do that. I decided to do Zoom meeting with readers instead of doing a big talk with a lot of readers in the audience. I did limit it to 15 people at a time. And the reason why I wanted to do that was I was also curious about their lives as well. And so I did a few sessions of those and I heard what they had to say. And I realized that there were women, not only women, but there were people who live in the corporate world. They want to change things, but they feel isolated or helpless. And I felt like if we come up with a way to support each other. And one of the women who was in the audience in the first session was talking about how her company had a contract with DHC, whose chairman had been writing these very hateful racist posts. And she was very sad and depressed about it. And I think we talked about what she can do collectively. And I felt the power of collective thinking and shared knowledge. And slowly that online meeting became more like, it was just, originally it was just a talk session over a book. But as I started my newsletter on Substack, it became a regular session. And I wanted to know what my readers were interested in and what they wanted to know and what I could do to support them. And Sakamak Study, which is a lecture series that came out of that as well. All of this has been pretty much kind of accidental. When I get invited to talk about my life, I always feel a little bit embarrassed because it's not like I plan things. Everything kind of happens in a very passive way. And a therapist once said to me that I talk about my life like it happens to me. I'm definitely guilty of that. So I don't know if anybody can hear my life story and take anything away from it. But yeah, that's how it always happens.
Well, I mean, I think in addition to there being such raw honesty in your conversations, you have this great skill as a writer to be able to articulate and communicate your opinions or help create dialogue between other women is incredibly powerful. And so even in something like Mondai no Mondai, which I'd love for you to explain as well, like you can pose something, but it's almost you're posing it and articulating it in such a way that it helps other people create dialogue around it.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if it was really intentional. I always felt I wanted to be a straight shooter and I always wanted to tell it like it is. But I always felt that there was this need to point out that some of the things that happened in Japan are not normal. I think if I lived there, I'm in Japan right now. If I lived there full time, I might get numb, get used to it. But I think that I'm in a unique position to point that out to people that this is not normal and we don't have to sit here and take it.
For the English speaking audience, do you mind kindly sharing like an example or two of what those not normal things are?
Yes. So Mondai no Mondai is an Instagram account that talks about that it's in a form of quiz and it goes through things that people might have forgot already that happened in Japan in the past. So one of the things that we turned it into a quiz was this congresswoman had a scandal and prosecutors ended up finding a hard disk. Mm. It was a financial scandal and she resigned for it. But the prosecutors found a hard drive that was drilled through. And there was, so that meaning that there was an attempt to destroy the evidence. And she resigned, but she ran for the election again, and she's now in office. The other thing is that among OECD countries, Japan, the wage gap between men and women are the second largest, or that Japan's ranking when it comes to general ways, Japan kept sliding down in the ranking, right? And supposedly we're the third biggest economy in the world. And the poverty, the people who live under the poverty line, like the population keeps growing and growing. And all these things are not normal. We don't have to accept it as a reality. We can talk about it. I think that Japanese people have always been told to stay silent and be content because we're able to live. And that's not how it should be. I think the Japanese people should want more, and Japanese people can be vocal. And I want to inspire people to be that.
Yeah, I feel like you're often saying that you don't necessarily have to be barely making it. There are policy changes that can be made so that people aren't just barely making it, or they can't get off work to go vote, or there are things that we can change, but we have to be active participants in that change rather than assuming that whether they vote or not, they don't vote, things will always be the same. So why participate in the first place? And I'm wondering, is that a result of the way that we've been educated?
You know, I do think that there was a sense of safety and security, even though when I came out of school, I think there was definitely, not for women, but for most men, I think there was a sense of security and sense of safety in Japan. There was like a sense of job protection and job security that was applied to most people. That got dismantled by the politicians of Liberal Democratic Party. And there was a sense of everybody being middle class, right? So that got dismantled over the years too. And on top of that, there was always this gender inequality, which I was somewhat oblivious to because I didn't know women who went to work for these companies. There was like a different way of calling positions that were especially like reserved to women, and the wage are lower. They might not necessarily do less work, but their pay is lower. And it's called panshoku. Or they took the government jobs, like local governments took away job security, and more people work without job security, meaning that they're almost like temp workers. And I think all these changes happened so slowly that people didn't realize what was happening. And I didn't realize what was happening. And I think that we're finally realizing why the poverty is more a serious issue, why there are long lines to soup kitchens and free food, and why women are killing themselves. Literally, like, more women are killing themselves now than, say, 10 years ago or even last year.
Yes, yes.
And it's heartbreaking. And I'm in a position that I could talk about this. But I think a lot of people don't feel safe to voice their opinions. For example, I, you know, often talk about being vocal and saying your opinions, and people are afraid, and I get it. But, and that was sort of, I was saying all these things without actually realizing what it meant. And one of my readers reached out to me and said that she voiced her opinion in her company, and she was called into a conference room and surrounded by a bunch of men and yelled at. And when you visualize that, it's very intimidating and scary and wrong, right? But that's the reality for some women. And safety first, right? So I said, like, do not risk your safety. But until she reached out to me, I didn't realize that was the reality for some women. And if we are in a position to say something, we should all say something. And that's what I tried to tell people.
What I was just thinking about with just the way we were educated is that where Japanese people are really good at listening and absorbing, but not necessarily raising your hand and saying something that is controversial or different. And so your work, like with, the checklist for everyone's future, it gives people a very specific to-dos. And that can be very helpful for our generation who were kind of taught to be good listeners rather than good doers.
Yes. All right. Let me touch upon the previous question a little bit. I do think that I was always considered to be a bad student, right? Because I would always question authority, say, like, why do I have to wear a uniform? And in my world, the answer was always because you do. But I always wanted to find answers. And that made me a very bad student because in their mind, I was always talking back. But so answering your question, I think that taking orders obediently, that was considered to be good in the Japanese education system. And when you finish your school and go out to the world, that's not how things work. So people who are good, who listen well, end up being in more difficult position. I feel like that happens to a lot of readers of mine. We call it Minna no Mirai Project, was a project where we sent a list of 67 questions to the political parties before the election so that people can make their educated decisions on which party to vote for. But it was also our way of trying to imagine how the world could look like when we're more inclusive and diverse and embracing and making sure that nobody gets left behind. And I worked with a group of activists who I had not known existed in the previous world, in pre-COVID world. And that was such an inspiring, I'm talking about activists who have always worked to support refugees who come to Japan and ended up in jail for indefinite period of time. I knew that there was that issue. I knew that there was this insane lack of consideration of human rights in the part of the Japanese authorities, but I didn't fully realize how bad they were. And I didn't realize there were people who worked tirelessly and selflessly to help people who are still stuck in the Japanese immigration system.
We've just been talking about the things that are not normal or should not be considered normal, and that we have this opportunity to kind of wake up to that reality and question and make change here in Japan. But also on the flip side, I do think that there are things that Japan does very well. And in fact, that perhaps the world can learn from some of the hints that Japan can share. And I was wondering if there's anything that you've come across in your conversations with women, or as you write and compare and contrast between life in Tokyo versus life in New York, for example, of the kind of power of Japanese wisdom, so to speak, that can help shape the way in which we tackle some of the most critical issues of our times.
What type of things do you have?
Well, in my everyday work, it's really about diving into kind of the historical practices and ethos around the Japanese table and food culture. And
right.
I think that there are some things in Japan that have been done for 2,000 years that can then inform the way in which the world can think about the overall food system, how we interact with the earth, with agriculture. And part of the problem is that because Japanese people have been educated to listen very well, we also haven't been very good at sharing these things. And so I was wondering if there's some things that Japanese people can and should share about the things that are obvious to us, but may not necessarily be obvious to the rest of the world.
Right. I hear you. So I think there are a lot of things. And these things are forgotten by Japanese people, too. And I do think that I definitely want to remind my fellow Japanese readers. But I love the phrase motainai. And motainai became sort of picked up, like it was picked up by Wangari Maathai. She was a former member of a Kenyan National Assembly, but she was also an environmental and political activist. And she picked up this phrase motainai as something that everybody should adopt. And I do not know how to translate motainai, but how would you translate this?
You know, it's such a difficult thing. I mean, I think part of it is like this idea of like things shouldn't go to waste. and and yeah, it is very difficult. There's no direct translation,
right? This idea that it's a shame to let something go waste, and that's something that, say, my grandma's generation would say, right? I can't really tell you when was the last time I heard that phrase. And I try to say that to people because there's a sense of motainai. Up until a certain point, people adopted using paper towels instead of cloth. People shifted to plastic bags from Hiroshiki. And the amount of waste, amount of garbage, because Japanese people are so tidy and they're so good at neatly putting waste away, it's not something that people think about. When I try to use the phrase motainai, it's to Japanese people most of the time, but I think it's something that the whole world should adapt because our resources are limited.
Yes, absolutely. And also motainai is not necessarily just about physical, tangible, because I was just thinking as you were speaking, it's also about kind of missed opportunity. And that's very much linked to what we were talking about before, which is it's motainai, it's a missed opportunity not to be voting, for example, saying and sharing your opinion or speaking up when you think something's not right.
I didn't think about it that way, but that is so true. That is so true. I always consider my voting right very seriously. It was something that was always important to me, but that was because I was always just a political kid. And I think being in the States, you're exposed to watching the long lines to the voting booths every election cycle. And when you are exposed to that, you think it's a precious thing. There's that story that's missing from Japan, that people worked hard to earn you that right. That sense of that civic duty and sense of the sense that it's a heartfelt right that was given to you is missing. And that's motainai is definitely a phrase that could be applied to that.
Yes. Yes. I think so. Yes. And I guess to kind of expand on that a little bit, I guess I was interested in hearing your thoughts on the value of Japanese women's voices and potential power in the global conversation and what our strengths are and also what our responsibility is. I mean, you pretty much touched upon some of these things throughout our conversation, but I was wondering if there's kind of this one thesis statement you have about the responsibility of Japanese women.
I was very inspired by the wave of feminism in Korea. And there are a lot of books that were translated from Korean into Japanese. And we're often, Japan and Korea, often occupy the very bottom of gender equality map, which is very sad. But I think that the fact that they were fighting and screaming for their right before Japanese women woke up to that inspired me tremendously. And I do think that women, when we work collectively beyond the borders and beyond cultures, the impact could be limitless. The impact that we can give, we can make, could be limitless.
Yes, yes. No, absolutely. And I think in order to do that, we need to have these conversations. And frankly, we haven't been very good about having conversations until recently. And so I'm so just feel so empowered by the work that you're doing kind of above and beyond your day job, so to speak, because it really helps people, I don't know, kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel and understand kind of where they're running toward.
Yeah, thankfully, we have unlimited source of inspirations, right? When you look at women from previous generations who have fought risking their lives, I always felt that my life is quite easy and that I need to use my voice and I need to use everything that I have in my power to inspire changes. And I do think that there are a lot of people who are in that position, and including men, change only happen when so many people can join the movement. And in one of those Korean feminism books, there was a paragraph about how long it would take for women to earn equal age at the current pace. And that was way over 100 years or something. When you realize that is probably not going to be achieved before your life ends. This was inspired by a friend of mine who said this. She said that when you realize that it won't happen before your life ends, you, not that you're going to take it as a reality and feel helpless, but you're going to have to come up with a way that you stay hungry and you keep demanding for change, but also enjoy your life. Because it's not going to end. You still have to live your life. And I do think that you said beyond my day job, but I do think that I do all these things because I want to sleep well. I want to sleep well every night. I want to feel like I did everything that I could do so that I get good night's sleep and not feel helpless. People often say there's nothing you can do. That's not true. There are a lot of things you can do.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, even your part of your Sakumug study, the We Act publications, the collection, that phrase alone speaks to all of the things that we can do instead of feeling like we're stuck in a position where we're just on the receiving end of things that are done to us. And it helps to keep us empowered and hopeful and also very appreciative of the things that we have currently.
Yes, I know. I often try to remind myself of women in other cultures that might be in bigger danger. For example, like women in Afghanistan right now, or women in Iraq, or women in Syria. And luckily, we can be more aware of women in other cultures because thanks to internet, the idea of intersectionality, that we should stand up for each other, something that I try to practice and often forget about, but it's very important.
Yes.
We in a lucky position should fight for other women as well. And not just women, anybody who's underrepresented.
Thank you so much, Yumiko-san. Oh. It gives me so much happiness to hear your story. And it just brings so much light, actually. Even though we're talking about extremely kind of sometimes heavy topics, we're able to talk about it because we live in the light. So thank you so much.
Yes, it's so easy to feel disappointed, but I try to approach everything with love instead of hate, even though I do feel angry and resentful at times. I tell women that it's okay to be angry. Of course you're angry, but try to approach everything with love because love will save you in the end.
Yes, I couldn't say it better myself. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.